During World War I, on Christmas Day, French, British, and German soldiers laid down their arms and climbed up out of the trenches to exchange holiday greetings. It's known as the Christmas Truce. And Emory University professor Patrick Allitt has joined me before to talk about it. Here he is with an explanation of what happened in the lead-up to the Christmas truce.
When the war began, the idea was that it was all going to be over incredibly quickly. Warfare had become so highly industrialized in the preceding 100 years that all the great nations were afraid that whoever mobilized first would win very quickly. That obviously proved to be a massive miscalculation because defensive weapons were so much more powerful than offensive ones. So then both sides got stuck in the trenches. And the casualty rates also horrified everybody, that literally every day hundreds of people, sometimes thousands, were being killed. So already by Christmas of 1914, when the war had been going on for 4 months, there was a terrible feeling of exhaustion and disillusionment. And the soldiers all more or less spontaneously said, we're going to take a day off from this. They certainly weren't authorized to do it.
Well, one of those soldiers was Captain Charles Stockwell, one of the first soldiers to take part in the truce. And we have, actually, this is a dramatic reading of one of his letters about this day. This comes from the History Channel.
I ran out into the trench and found that the Saxons were shouting, "Don't shoot. We don't want to fight today. We will send you some beer." A German officer appeared and walked out into the middle of no man's land. So I moved out to meet him amidst the cheers of both sides. We met and formally saluted. He introduced himself as Count something or other and seemed a very decent fellow.
Very decent. That's British, isn't it? But first of all, let's talk about what no man's land is. What is that?
Because the weapons were so dangerous, the men very rapidly realized they had to dig trenches into the ground simply to stay out of sight of one another, to stay alive. And so all the way across northern Europe, from the North Sea coast to the Swiss border, lines of trenches developed. And very often the English soldiers would only be a couple of hundred yards from the German soldiers, each group in their own trenches, and each with the knowledge that if they appeared above the parapet of the trench, they'd be shot. And throughout the war, that's what happened. But they were close enough that they could hear each other's conversations. And as we just heard in that extract, very often the Christmas truce began with the singing of carols, and each side could hear the other. The German high command had also had the idea of sending Christmas trees to their men. Christmas trees were originally a German tradition. And sometimes the Germans would decorate the trees and put them up on the parapet so the English soldiers could see them. And when the singing started, and then especially when people on both sides started holding up white flags or holding up signs that said, "Don't shoot and we won't shoot," the slightly braver ones took the risk of climbing up and exposing themselves, which normally would be lethal, to begin to fraternize. I think also at first some of the truces were a very practical matter, that when men were shot during raids and attacks, sometimes their bodies would continue to lie there. And one of the things that happened during the truce was simply coming out to both sides agreeing to bury the bodies of the men from their own sides. But then it also led to fraternization, like the exchanging of tobacco, the exchanging of alcohol, like this officer mentioned, and then also to playing soccer matches.
So why was there no Christmas truce of 1915?
Because when the senior officers heard about what had happened in 1914, they were absolutely furious about it. Their view was, I mean, on the British side, for example, there was, "We're fighting a war for freedom. Why on earth would you interrupt the quest for freedom to fraternize with the very people whose job it's your job to kill? They're the enemies of civilization. They're not people we should fraternize with." And so some of the people who'd participated in the truce were punished. Some were circulated out to different parts of the Western Front. And when Christmas 1915 came along and the war was still going on, very strict orders went out that nobody was to expose themselves to the enemy, and that if they saw any sign of concessions from the enemy, they were to shoot them down instantly. And so from then on, there was no subsequent Christmas truce.
The opera Silent Night is a creative retelling of the story of the Christmas truce, when French, German, and British soldiers laid down their arms during World War I. It was the run-up to Christmas of 1914. We just told you the history of that event. Now let's hear what it sounds like when it's set to music. Kevin Putz is the composer of Silent Night, and baritone Troy Cook stars in the production as Father Palmer. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kevin, the opera is called Silent Night. Does that mean you needed a version of that Christmas carol in it somewhere?
Well, to the displeasure of some, there is no instance of that Christmas carol. we just thought it was a good title for a piece where, you know, it was silent, no bombs and no shooting. But all the music in the opera is original, including several Christmas carols that we had fun writing on our own.
So why this subject, Kevin? What drew you to this particular story?
Well, it was actually the idea of Dale Johnson, who is the artistic director of the Minnesota Opera. He contacted me kind of out of the blue. He had heard some of my orchestral music and had in his mind that he wanted to make the French film of 2005 called Joyeux Noël on this subject into an opera. And he thought that my music sounded like a step in the right direction. So we talked, and I saw the film, and with what little experience at the time I had with opera, I could imagine a lot of it on the stage, and I thought it would be very beautiful sung. And then I met Mark Campbell, the librettist, and we shared ideas about it and just went from there.
Well, let's hear a little bit of it. This is the sleep chorus from this opera, Silent Night. This is a moment when soldiers from all of the armies are on stage together. They're settling in for the night. They speak in their respective languages, German, French, and English. And this is a performance from the Cincinnati Opera. So it can be, Troy, difficult sometimes and scary when it's a new opera, right?
Sure. And also exciting, I have to say.
Why do you say that?
Well, I remember going through the workshop process of doing this opera, and there was just this feeling in the room, this palpable feeling that something really special was being created. And I guess when you think about doing a new opera, if you're a presenter and you're doing it, something completely unknown, and you have to sell it to an audience, that is the scary part.
Right.
But that's one thing that I'm here to tell you, there's nothing in Silent Night to be afraid of, because it won the Pulitzer Prize for a reason.
In 2012, yeah.
Absolutely.
So, you know, if, say, Don Giovanni's about is a cautionary tale, and, you know, many of the other operas are basically about revenge, what is the deeper theme behind this one, do you think?
I think this has to do with humanity, the commonality of simply being a human being. You can be, like in the trenches of World War I, in a horrible, horrible situation, but these gentlemen in this story, they were able to see through all of that into each other's commonality, what is common between them, and into their humanity as well.
And what do you feel about that, Kevin, in terms of the deeper themes behind this opera? What do you feel is actually happening on stage? Where have you taken the audience by the time the opera ends?
Well, I think that when Mark Campbell and I write any opera, we're almost finished with three now, we always need to have some idea of what it's about, and we kind of hold that as our mantra. And I think with Silent Night, our idea was that once you know your enemy, they sort of no longer become your enemy. And I think that kind of naivety and ignorance of the other side, of other cultures, is at the heart of so many problems that we have, not only politically and, you know, as in terms of country, but even like different types of people and, you know, religions and sexual orientations and all kinds of things. So just because there's such distance, there's no contact. Once there is contact, it's difficult to maintain that relationship of being enemies, I think.
So let's hear a little bit more of it. This is from Opera Philadelphia, their production of Silent Night. So, Troy, you have sung in several different productions of this.
Yes, this is my second production, and for a piece that's been written so recently, for it to already have two productions.
Right, and that's my question. Yeah. Why do you think this has such resonance?
I think it truly goes back to the humanity thing. I think people can see themselves on the stage. And I think, you know, with things, with timeless stories like La Boheme, people are able to see themselves and their friends on the stage and relate in a very immediate way. And I feel that's true with this piece. Like, the horrors of World War I are immense. And to try to take all of that horror in is overwhelming to a person. But if you whittle it down to three storylines, basically, of three different troop members, it allows you into that life in a way that won't overwhelm you, that you can actually understand what it was like.
That is Troy Cook. He sings the role of Father Palmer in the opera Silent Night. It's the story of the Christmas truce on stage, maybe truth as well, at the Atlanta Opera November 5th, 8th, 11th, and 13th. You can find showtimes at atlantaopera.org. Kevin Putz composed the music. Thank you both so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
I want to bring another voice into this conversation to maybe broaden it out. John Horgan is a science journalist who teaches at Stevens Institute of Technology, and he's the author of the book called The End of War. Hi, John.
Hi.
And I want to go back to this question about the resonance of this particular opera. And Troy was talking about people being able to see themselves on stage. And I wonder if it feels at this point as though, even though Americans, for example, are not hopefully taking up arms with one another, maybe it feels as though we're at a war of some kind politically.
Yeah, I just have to say, I've always loved this story of the Christmas truce. It almost sounds like a fantasy, but it's true. And I think the possibility that's raised in my mind by this event is of all soldiers laying down their arms. I mean, why can't we have a world in which we all recognize our common humanity and give up this terrible, irrational form of resolving our conflicts? This has been an age-old hope. It is dismissed by the vast majority of people today as a pipe dream, as impossibly utopian. It's a kind of paradise that we will never achieve. So I wrote The End of War to try to convince people that the abolition of war, world peace, is actually possible. And that what you had with the Christmas truce, we could have that on a global scale. That's my hope, and I actually think that that could happen quite rapidly.
You still think that, and I want to test that out, because I'm reading this news story this morning about militia groups here in Georgia who already mobilizing for rifle practice and hand-to-hand combat and training for November 8th should Hillary Clinton win.
It's a scary period right now, and of course there's the terrible conflict in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. Yeah. War still exists around the world. But what people should know is that there has been a massive decline of all kinds of violence over the past few centuries around the world, and war in particular has really declined since the end of World War II. War between global powers has pretty much disappeared. There are very serious civil wars around the world. But my hope is that if we have the will, and if we can overcome our fatalism and despair about ending war, that we can end it quite rapidly. I think that this should be the goal of all intellectuals, all of the people in our national security establishment. I'm hopeful that the United States, which right now is a very warlike, violent nation, can be a leader in taking the entire world toward a permanent peace.
We got a message from one of our listeners. Scotty Simmons writes this. During the manipulations for the war in Iraq, I had a worldwide wish and visual fantasy that came to me in epic color and action. I saw all major nations landing their armies and equipment in Iraq under orders from the United Nations Assembly to stop that war. This type of action would be used in all countries from that point forward. Now, that's a vision Scotty had. If any of you out there have visions or thoughts about this, you can post them to our Facebook page or tweet us at OST Talk. I'm speaking with John Horgan, whose latest book is The End of War. So, John, you say that there's actually been a decline in violence. Why then do we feel as though there's been an increase?
Well, here in the United States, we actually have very high rates of homicide compared to, for example, Western Europe, and we have been embroiled in these wars ever since 9/11. I teach at a university in New Jersey, and I have students who have never known their country not to be at war. And so we're immersed in these stories and images of war, so it's natural that we think of the world as profoundly violent. And it is still a scary, dangerous place, but there are very positive global trends, and we just have to build on those. And by the way, responding to what your listener said, I don't think the solution to ending war is a gigantic war. That's what some people thought about World War One, and that didn't exactly work out.
And okay, so here's the thing, though, John. As far as I know, and I'm no historian, or certainly not an ancient historian, we don't really have in recorded history a period of time when the entire world was at peace.
Yeah, there have almost always been hot spots here and there, but there have been periods of relative peace. For example, after the Napoleonic Wars in the early 19th century, Europe was just totally exhausted. And there was a period of relative peace that, of course, was demolished when World War One broke out. After World War One, there was such horror at all the carnage that there was a really powerful peace movement in the United States and in Europe. And in World War Two, the Nazis ended that. I'm hopeful, and you know, this is my hope is inspired in part by stories like the Christmas Truce. I'm hopeful that we can have a coalition of traditional anti-war activists and leftists, joined by religious people whose own scriptures preach peace, and even fiscal conservatives who should be appalled at the immense waste of our defense spending, that we can have this broad coalition of people who just demand that our country start seeking nonviolent means of resolving its conflicts, and that we can start moving away from this period of militarism quite rapidly. I really think that's possible if we have tough, imaginative, courageous leadership.
And yet the reason we're talking about this is because of this opera at the Atlanta Opera, Silent Night, which is the story of the Christmas Truce, and it'll be on stage for four nights now in November. And based on the story of that opera, which is a true story, and what you just talked about, John, it almost sounds as like the only periods of relative peace that we've had in the world have been after horrifying war and loss of life.
Well, so here's when people are really pessimistic about war. So my students, the vast majority of them, almost every student in every class that I've taught, has thought that war is a permanent part of the human condition, and they say that humans are inherently selfish and greedy, and you know, as long as somebody disagrees with somebody else's ideology, we're going to have war, or want something that somebody else has. And I often teach in a classroom right across the Hudson River from New York City, and I say, look over there at New York. There are people with every possible ideology, poor people, rich people, Republicans, Democrats, and yet New York City, believe it or not, is remarkably peaceful. Even rates of homicide have declined drastically since the late 80s and early 90s. You also have large portions of the world, for example, South America, which were once quite warlike and are now peaceful. Recently, because of the peace declared in Colombia, the entire Western Hemisphere is war-free. So I like to point to these examples of localized regions of peace to give people hope that we can achieve this on a global scale.
So we have about a minute left, a little less, John. What is our first step? Is it to stop arguing on Facebook?
That might help, although, you know, we're a fractious species. I think we're gonna continue arguing. I would never expect that kind of conflict to cease. What I hope is that people realize that ending war is not a fantasy. It's not a hippie pipe dream. It is an achievable goal, and it's a moral imperative as much as ending slavery was. If we have the will to do it, and if we demand that our leaders seek it, we can achieve it.
That is John Horgan. His latest book is The End of War. John, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Celeste.